So just 3 days into phase three of OTAs for the New York Jets, and to say there's drama would be an understatement. What's up, Jets fans? Welcome to another edition of Jet Nation Live. We are your hosts, Dylan Terriman and Glenn Naughton. Like I said right at the top, drama. After only 3 days of practice, we're going to dive right into it. And we also have a special guest, Van Halen historian and author of Van Halen Rising, Greg Renoff. He's a Jets fan. You probably know him from Twitter. His bio says multi-decade victim of the New York Jets, and hopefully we're going to be on the upswing of changing that. But before I introduce him, how are we doing tonight, Glenn?
I'm doing great. You know, OTA's underway. You know, like you said, there can never be anything without a little bit of drama. But really excited to have Greg on. You know, engaged with him quite a bit on Twitter over the years about the Jets and rock music and stuff like that. So great to get him on, talk a little bit. Check out his books. Van Halen Rising, and also Ted Templeman, a music producer's life in music. Van Halen Rising, how a Southern rock or a Southern California band saved rock and roll. Just great Jet fan and great music fan. So really a perfect guy to have on.
Yeah, and like you said, it's probably not going to be strictly Jets. We're going to get into some music talk at the end for sure. So
and listen, it's getting to that time of year where we're going to throw in a couple of random topics. 100%. You know, there's only so much we're going to talk more about the draft picks. You know what I mean? Like
exactly.
And so we'll have an episode where we spend a few minutes on some of our favorite books and whatever jokes, movies, comedians. It's that time of year, folks.
Exactly. It's kind of replacing our draft segment until we dive deeply into 2024, but. Without further ado, let's bring him on, Greg Renoff.
What's Greg, up, guys? How are you
doing? Not much. How are you? Greg. Thanks for joining.
Absolutely. Yeah, thanks for coming on, Greg. It's been a while. You know, as I said at the top, we've been hoping to get you on for a little while now and get your thoughts on the Jets. And you know, maybe we were just waiting for a time when we had a quarterback worth talking about. You know, obviously Aaron Rodgers, the big story this offseason. You know, how in your mind, you know, is this a thing where you think this vaults the Jets into Super Bowl contention? Or do you think it makes them sort of a team that is a team that can make a playoff push, but do you think there's still some pieces they need to enter the Super Bowl conversation?
Well, I'll throw a little humor into the mix that you'll appreciate, I think, Glenn, is that I thought Neil O'Donnell was going to get us over the top and get us to the Super Bowl. So, you know, it's like all about the perspective on your history as a Jets fan. But, I mean, look, the last decade has been a little challenging to be a Jets fan and to have a guy who has come in and by all accounts has really changed the culture already and has really kind of, I don't know, shook the complacency out of a lot of guys maybe who just were, you know, not used to having a vet presence like that in the locker room. No offense to Flacco or anyone else who's been around, but clearly this is a person who has a different stature in the league, a different charisma, a different record. You know, it really is. It's set up to be, if you don't get to, you know, to the Super Bowl, it probably is seen as a failure of a season. I mean, that's the reality. That's the expectation. I mean, you know, I really enjoy, you know, I don't do too much Jet stuff on Twitter. I do some back and forth to people, but I leave that to the big boys out there. We honor the usual suspects who really do a good job on that. And it's like, people are already gunning for the Jets. It's already like, it's actually kind of amusing. It's like, you know, like people like casting hate at Rodgers and, you know, already like, you know, conspiring to say the Jets are going to win three games this year. So it's, you know, this is it. This is it. I mean, maybe there's 2 years, but to me, you can't come out of this season, you know, with a loss in a wild card game or something like that and think like, oh, we did something. You did nothing basically except spend a bunch of money and, you know, not get there.
Yeah, it's funny. That seems to be a divisive point. I mean, well, what isn't with the Jets? Everything, the color of the uniforms is a divisive point. But, you know, I'm in that camp where you've opened up a window where you do something special or it's a fail. You know, but there is, I've literally seen people like who've said, you know, Aaron Rodgers makes us a playoff contender. I'm like, no, Ryan Tannehill makes you a playoff contender. You know, that's not, you didn't go out and get Aaron Rodgers
right
to win a playoff
no, I agree.
Game, you know, completely different ball game. Yeah. So right. I think you're right. It's got to be something special. It can't be a play. We've had playoff games. We had playoff wins. You know, it's got to be more than that. And it's got to be bigger. So we'll see where it takes us. But great point with, you know, I mentioned this with, I can't remember, Dylan, if it was with you. I know I mentioned it with Scott. I can't remember if it was his show or our show. But I was saying how it's funny that we're already seeing fans who are like the excuses that you make before you play a good team. Like, they're already making them now about the Jets. Oh, the Jets got an advantageous schedule and they're going to be so well rested. It's unfair, right? And it's a conspiracy. It's like, wow, people are making Jets excuses before the season starts. Like, yep. You don't generally see that.
Right.
Yeah, normally we're the team doing that, making the excuses as we see the schedule. Like, well, you know, we have hard teams where we could pass up for 8-8, yeah, 9-7, whatever.
Looking at ways that the deck, you feel like the deck is stacked against you. Like, oh,
exactly.
And when you're bad, the deck kind of is. Like, not that the league's doing it, but you do see, like, the doom and gloom in every opponent when you don't have a quarterback. Right. But, yeah, you know, there's a lot of teams.
Go ahead. To Greg's point, I was going to say, we're just – New York has always been under the microscope, and then you add a player like Aaron Rodgers who brings his own headlines from whether it's on or off the field, and you're just going to intensify that microscope, so to speak. So I'm not surprised that any of this has transpired over the past 3 days in OTAs. I mean, you can have your take on the Aaron Rodgers injury, and we're definitely going to get into that. I kind of lean to the side of, you know what, he didn't care for all those mass media people coming to see him. He's just going to tweak a calf in practice. And you know what? He'll be out there next week when less media members are there. Right. And everybody came out for a big hoopla for Aaron Rodgers. They saw 15 minutes of conditioning and wrapped it up. So they got to see Zach Wilson up close in person. But yeah, I agree. The microscope is always going to be under the Jets.
Yeah. And look, it's been refreshing to see the plan come together again. I, you know, Glenn, I know that you were kind of a car guy, and I think on paper I probably was too. I thought, like, it's a lot to give up to get a quarterback that, you know, I think that the Jets with Carr are a team that had Super Bowl potential. I really do think that. Rodgers is, 100%. I think, a better quarterback. I mean, the age thing aside, but the cost to give up, the picks and everything, and of course then the along with the salary was a big risk. I mean, but you know, that's another thing I'd like to maybe touch on with you guys at some point is, like, you know, to me, looking at the coaching staff and looking at the general manager, I mean, people are saying things like, I hear, like, oh, you know, if the Jets don't make the playoffs, it's like you got to fire Saleh. And I'm just thinking to myself, are you crazy? Like, I don't think he's been perfect and there's things he's done wrong. But, like, compared to what we've had in the last decade, I mean, this guy is like by far the best coach. You know, free agents want to come play for him. I mean, you heard Rodgers say, like, I wanted to play for this guy. If we had, like, again, you know, God rest his soul, he's gone off to wherever he's gone off to his retirement. But, you know, if he had Adam Gase, there's no chance Rodgers would want to play here, no matter how much money or what. He would never have come here.
Nope.
So, you know, so that's the thing. It's like, I think people, you know, again, it's going to be a failure if they don't make it to the Super Bowl or again, like, you know, maybe, you know, the championship game, something like that. You think, like, that would be like, maybe, like, we're just at the doorstep. But, you know, I think all things considered, the whole body of work of Saleh and this GM has been generally good and much better than we've had. I mean, you look back, it's been a disaster in a lot of ways. A lot of things that have happened from the GM down to the coaches. I don't want, and I'll let you guys hop in, but to me, it's like, I'm not out on those guys. If they, you know, if they win 9 games this year, you know, I'm not out. 8 games, I'm not out. I mean, you know, there would have to be extenuating circumstances to say, look, this happened. It couldn't be like a Karoon meltdown or something catastrophic in terms of that type of thing. But, like, I'm in, you know, I'm in for, like, you know, like, a just let it ride with these guys for a few years.
Yeah. I think as far as that goes, the people, I hate when people put, like, I hate win predictions in a sense that, you know, or, you know, fan mandated playoff mandates. Oh, if they don't do this, you have to fire them. If they don't win this, and I'm like, how do you say that? You have no idea how this is going to unfold. If you lose, you know, if you're in week 17 playing for a playoff spot, like, let's say Rodgers misses some weeks and you steal a few wins with a backup quarterback against quality opponents, and then you miss the playoffs on, say, a blown call at the whistle. You then going to fire Robert Saleh because, like, a replay shows that the refs missed the call and that's why you lost the game. And now you're going to fire the guy who almost got you there with having to have Zach Wilson or somebody like a Teddy Bridgewater under center for a chunk of time if they get a guy like Bridgewater. And that's a topic we'll touch on later, Greg. But one thing I wanted to ask you, because you mentioning Neil O'Donnell reminds you that we've probably been fans for about the same amount of time. I think you may predate me a little, but we're in that same ballpark. We've both seen a lot of the same ups and downs. You mentioned what a tough decade this has been. And when you said that, anytime someone talks about these past 10 years, and even with Dylan, even you don't have to have watched this team as long as we did. Like, we all know how rough the Adam Gase years were. And you mentioned Adam Gase. Like, for me personally, even though you can say Kotite's worse, I think when that debate takes place, I understand Kotite probably was worse, but I have so much disdain for Adam Gase. I'm like, no, he was the worst. Like, I don't want to hear it. But Kotite, in a lot of ways, really was. Gase did some things that were as dumb as Kotite did, though. But was that for you, Greg? Because me, the Adam Gase years were the low point, my low point as a fan. Like, I never before did I think to myself, like, before he was fired, I was like, I really have to consider not watching next year. Like, this is bad for my mental health, watching this team and watching this guy. I want to put my foot through my television every week. And to me, the Gase years were the low point of my, 35, 36 years, however I've been watching.
Yeah, I think what was interesting is that I remember so vividly, I was actually talking to Scott Minton back and forth by text message or by Twitter or something. And Carton and Roberts were on. I remember so vividly, like, they were talking about the coaches, and then somebody, I think Roberts said, like, Adam Gase, and, like, you know, Carton, I don't have to go through the thing, but you can imagine they were like, no way. And then it was like, almost like, it was like the slow motion train wreck. It was like, they're talking to Gase. You know, Gase has been plugged by Manning. And it was like, you know, you can't be doing this. I mean, you cannot legitimately, but I think I think of like a musical chairs thing, and they were like worried they were going to be out, and then they lost whatever they were down to, whoever they were down to. And then, of course, when, like, Peyton Manning says, oh, you're the guy. But it was extremely frustrating because so many reasons. I would think the thing is, we will never know with Darnold what might have been with different coaching. I mean, obviously he had, you know, three different offensive coordinators, the whole nine yards. And again, the body of work is the body of work. Guys overcome bad circumstances and become better players. And but then to have, like, a guy who really looked like, especially the end of that rookie year when he battled Rodgers down to the wire and had those four games at the end of his rookie year, meaning Darnold, where was like so much hope that he was actually going to turn the corner, and then have it just go so bad. And then that was incredibly demoralizing. The one quick thing I'll say is about the Gase years, this dates me a little bit too. I was in graduate school, excuse me, not Gase, the Kotite years. I was in graduate school. So it was like 1995, 96. I was in graduate school. So there was no direct TV. Jets were never on TV. It's Mississippi, right? You would see a Falcons games. If you wanted to go watch football, you'd have to go watch a Falcons game at a bar or something, or like on TV. So I never saw a Jets game the whole year. I would get the New York Times. Was a paper that you could get, a New York paper in Mississippi, and I would read it. I just read these statistics, and I would just be like, you know, it was just so. I actually was kind of like, I had like a buffer between me. I didn't, like, probably not as frustrated as what a few who watched it. Like, I couldn't watch it,
right?
So Gase was worse in that standpoint of, like, actually watching, and you felt like sometimes you see people in life, you're like, you're making a bad decision, and you're not, you know, sometimes it turns out okay, but a lot of times you have a gut feeling, this is a really bad decision. You try to tell them, like, this is a bad decision. And it's like, I guess no one could tell Christopher Johnson, you're making a bad decision. You're making a bad decision. This is the wrong hire. You know, this is the wrong hire. But I think that he just panicked and, like, was like, I gotta hire somebody. And this is the guy. And, you know, just certainly, like,
I think the Manning input played a huge role, and I think now Dylan is in awe at how old you and I are.
These guys
were alive in a time where you had to read about the games in the newspaper.
100%. 100%.
Yeah, I actually was in Florida at the time, but I would I used to go to a sports bar because it was the only way to watch. But I remember tweeting. Because, you know, you've been around long enough to know, Greg, like, the way the media plays these games, and sometimes teams will do a favor for a player or a coach and put their name out there as someone they're interested in. And that was I think it was Albert Breer was the first person to tweet that the Jets were interested in Adam Gase. And I tweeted out, this is clearly a favor to Gase's agent. Like, he is not a serious consideration. And then it happened, and I was like, he's literally, like, there was like 15 candidates. He was the only guy I looked at, went, no way they're hiring that guy. Sorry, Dylan, I interrupted.
No, you're fine. When I first reached out to Jet Nation and started writing for the site, one of my first things that I had to write about was the coaching search that led to Adam Gase. And right as I was about to submit it, you know, all the candidates, I think there was, like you said, a bunch of them, close to 10 I covered in like a short synopsis. We got the Gase news. And I was like, oh no. Like, I had to tongue in cheek go add his paragraph into the bottom of the thing. And I was like, I don't want this guy. Keep him away. Knowing that this was going to happen. And yep. Then I remember, like, we all knew it was just going to be bad, and we didn't expect it to be as bad as it was.
I just remember that opening presser.
You lost everybody from minute one of that press conference, and you never were able to get it back. Not a redeeming moment or a, you know, a gelling team moment for everybody to just hang their hat on, like, okay, maybe it could work. And we knew it probably wasn't going to be a one and done, but we all knew it should have been at a minimum one and done. They don't really fire in season coaches,
but
it should have been the first time they did.
Yeah. And look, and to bring it all full circle again, this is what I'm saying about with Salah. I'm not even comparing Salah to Gase. It means, in terms of where we've been as coaches. I mean, I just mean insofar as like, I'm not saying like anyone at this point really with Gase. He could be a middle of that guy and be like, oh yeah, he's much better than Gase, obviously, right? Anybody. But I mean, for anybody to say like, we should fire this coach and then go out there and like roll the dice on somebody again. And again, you know, I have no idea. Salah 5 years from now could turn out to be like a guy who just never got over the hump, and maybe he was not the guy, but like just some what I've seen in terms of, especially the middle of last season, how he had those guys playing with, look again, with like very mediocre quarterback play, like Zach had his moments and stuff like that, but it was clearly, you know, you don't have a franchise quarterback, you don't even think like even like a Tannehill type of guy on the team, and you're out there and you're 6-2, you're rolling, you're like surprising all these teams, the energy is unbelievable. And again, just to say like that wasn't sort of a sense of what this guy has in him, you know, I think is people are crazy. Anyone who wants to, like, again, I'm all in on solid it long term, that could be wrong, but just to think about like you try to start over and how we've seen it, like, oh, you know, these guys get introduced, it's like this is the new, you know, new guy, and like it's just one guy after another who's just not up to the job. And I think the fact that, you know, someone like Rodgers especially, like, is like, I want to play for this guy making millions, he could like do what he could do every week, he could retire, he'd like stay in Green Bay and like, you know, just mail it in or whatever. He was like, I want to go play for this guy, I'm excited to play for this guy. I mean, that's a Hall of Famer. That's a Hall of Famer guy saying, I want to play for this coach who hasn't won a Super Bowl. Hasn't won shit. Let's be honest. He hasn't won shit. You know, mm-hmm. NFL record is terrible. But for every guy to be like, I've won, you know, in this league. I have a Super Bowl ring. I'm a first ballot Hall of Famer. I'm top five quarterback conversation. To say, I want to play for this coach. I mean, what else do you need? It's like an endorsement, you know, like just be like, this guy obviously gets going to get players focused on the right thing and has the right energy to win.
Yeah, and I think you keep bringing back memories of all these coaching search articles that I had to write. And Salah was my number one choice when it came to like realistic candidates. I know like Bill Cowher was floated out there for like 72 hours that his wife is a diehard Jets fan. Right. So I was like, okay, yeah, let's do the dream pick. But Salah was right there as number one. And then I had Wink Martindale as number two. So maybe a little bit of my bias is going into this decision, but no, like there's probably nothing that Salah could do outside of like punching Woody Johnson on the field of play on a Sunday that like really could get him fired, in my opinion. And like, it goes to beyond the field, like what he has done with his coaching staff to gel with the front office and the scouts and be able to, you know, get players that fit this scheme. I think that's the clear difference from the Gase era years, is that we had no direction with what McCagnan and he were trying to do, even what he and Joe Douglas were trying to do. It just never was fitting together. And all of a sudden you see this coming together of coaching staff and front office scouts and getting the right players, right free agents into place that can actually win with your team. And that's exactly what they're going to prove they can do. So you don't get a statement like, I love working with Robert, if this is an Adam Gase or a Todd Bowles type of led team. So I completely agree. Salah is the determining factor in this team. And I think those who are still doubting him need to just you know, put aside the clock management issues. I think that's going to come over time when he's on the field trying to use his timeouts properly. But other than that, it's really hard to sit down and find a lot of flaws in his coaching ability. Like you said, players want to play for this guy. And I think that is A1 on the list of things that when they mention Saleh, it's always in a positive light and vice versa.
Yeah, I think, you know, I want to hear what you say, Glenn, but I just think, yeah, I mean, for me, so I'm of two minds. I think like everyone has to take a long look at themselves if they don't make it to the Super Bowl, or like I said, like a, you know, a last quarter loss in a championship game or something like that. You have to look at yourself. But like, I think compared to what we've had, I'm just like, yeah, I'm like, you know, let me just bring up two words for you. Corn Ferry. Do we want Corn Ferry picking the next GM? Like we had, like, I mean, like, oh my God.
That's, I mean, it goes to show you how desperate this team got. Like, I mean, look, obviously it blew up in their faces, but at the time, I mean, there's a lot of revisionist history, but people were actually excited about the, you know, Casserly and Wolf coming in to help with the GM. I don't think anybody was excited about Corn Ferry. That was like, who are these guys? You know, you just didn't even know who they were. It was one of those things. On the one hand, it's embarrassing that it got to that, but at the same time, I'm like, I kind of respect the fact that they realize, like, look, we keep screwing this up. Let's try something different, you know. Right. So it's like at least you realize you're screwing it up, but obviously, Corn Ferry did as bad a job as the Jets ever did, so that's why they never re-entered the equation. So it's been a lot of bad times. I think Saleh, you know, for me, Saleh was a guy. The inexperience worried me, and that's like they keep hiring guy after guy after guy after guy with no experience.
Totally fair.
You know, but then he is a guy, and I think anyone would agree to this. This isn't me lying because he's the coach now, and I like the guy, but when I knew nothing about him other than he was, you know, outgoing on the sideline, when I watched him in interviews, right, I was like, this dude really is impressive. Like, you can tell he's got this sort of this team vision, this accountability, and, you know, but like praising guys when they need to be praised. And I don't know, he seemed to have a really good mix. So, you know, in terms of what he will do as a football coach, I mean, we can all guess, but if he's never done it, we don't know. You know, that's why I always think it's funny when they hire a guy like Saleh. Yeah, he was a rock star, but he did kind of come from nowhere. You know, he was like a guy not many people were talking about, to like, now everybody wants him. And it's like, well, and you know, there's the concern with, well, yeah, he was good, but we saw the weapons he had, you know, the defensive weapons he had to work with, you know, was it him or the players? And now we're seeing that, like, he's got his stuff together. He's not perfect. Most coaches are. And that's part of it, Greg, that, you know, we're having this conversation about people that want to fire Robert Saleh, but how many great coaches, you know, got fired too early? You know, I mean, sometimes the firing helps. Guys take a step back. They reflect. Right. How could I have done better? This, that, the other. But I'm on board with what you're saying. Keep these guys around. Joe Douglas, you know, I think his offseason is one that there's a lot of, I think there's some good discussions to be had about that. That's something we'll probably do on a future episode. And for where the Jets are right now, like, and that, let's kind of have a part of that conversation now. Looking at this roster, is there anyone out there that you look at and say, or even just a position that you look at and say, man, I know the Jets feel good about themselves right now, but they should probably add something here or this player, or, you know, whether it's depth at safety or a starter at safety, like, where are the holes on this roster, as you know, in your opinion?
Well, I mean, I think that's the big one to me that always comes out is like safety. I mean, last year it was actually very surprising to me how the safeties underperformed. I think that was the biggest, you know, beyond quarterback, right, which I expected, you know, Zach to make the leap, and all, we don't have to get into that, but just sort of the safety play was really just underwhelming. And I think that, to me, you know, I know we all kind of expected that was going to be addressed maybe more aggressively than they did. But, you know, I think overall, I mean, the other issue, of course, is the tackles. I mean, that's a big, I mean, the Mekhi Becton experience has been interesting. I mean, like, his, like, you know, the last few days where he had did the article and everything. I mean, I think, fingers crossed, you know, he seems to be doing the right things finally, but he's lost a lot of time. And, you know, whatever issues he was dealing with, physical, mental, whatever it was, and, you know, to have that lost time and those lost reps, it's a lot of reps to lose. And so, you know, if he can't play, you know, last year, the offensive line was obviously a major, you know, especially after ABT went down, there was like a lot of, you know, just things between quarterback not getting the ball out fast enough and guys not holding up. It was, we really miss Becton. I mean, obviously a healthy Becton last year would have been like a completely different situation, even if ABT went down, I think. So that's a, you know, that's a major concern. If you have a guy who like top five pick, who you think is going to be top 10 pick, whatever he was, you think is going to be a starter if he's healthy, if he, you know, if he can't play again, if something happens, God forbid, and I certainly hope nothing does, you know, his record speaks for itself. That's going to be a huge, I think a big problem.
Yeah, I think, Dylan, that was something I was going to ask you tonight. You know, we'll get into it now with Greg being here. I did an article on it. And listen, for anyone who's, you know, unaware or doesn't watch this or listen to us regularly, I am and always have been a huge Mekhi Becton fan and supporter. I understand the frustration of the fans. I don't understand the actual, like, there's frustration, which I get, but there's also a lot of, like, well, a lot of, there's enough. Like legitimate hate for the guy, which I completely don't get. Even if you want to say he didn't do the right things as a rookie to lose the weight after the, or sorry, in his second year to lose the weight after the injury. I get it, but he's a young kid. Like maybe he made a mistake and had a little growing up to do. Everyone is sort of saying, oh, well, he's getting his act together because he wants his big money, which listen, first of all, would only put him in a group with every other player in the NFL. But the other thing is he had a kid. Like maybe having the kid was a wake up call to him that like, oh, I got to make this work because it's going to make my kid's life easier for generations if I do it right. So I'm willing to give him the benefit of that doubt. And I've defended Mekhi Becton every step of the way. However, those comments the other day, I mean, he wasn't just critical of the Jets. Like I glanced at it when it was first posted on the forums at JetNation.com.
Right.
And I went, oh man, not the best look, you know, but I didn't really, really like dig into it. Sure. Then later that night when I had some time, I read it and I was blown away. I think I missed the part the first time through because the first read through what jumped out at me was, how's your relationship with the coaching staff? It's okay. It is what it is. I'm like, that's a very lukewarm response. Like, even if it's not great, like there are some jobs in life where maybe you know, fudge things a little and that's one of them. But the thing that blew me away was him saying that he told his coaches he was hurt and they didn't listen and his knee buckled and he missed the season. I read that and my first thought was, this reads like testimony in a lawsuit. Like this reads like you were going to file a grievance and you're letting everyone know that the team ignored your pleas of being injured and they're the reason you missed it. Like that's potentially hugely damaging stuff. And I just read that and thought, I would love to know if Becton sat down at any point with anyone, because normally, and this isn't a Becton thing, this is an everybody thing, well, high profile guys, like a lot of this stuff is like pre-planned and orchestrated. Here's your talking points. You want to hit on this. You want to make sure you mention that. And I'm like, did anyone advise him on this and say, yeah, go in there and make sure you mention the fact that they're the reason you got hurt and missed the season. And so I'm not bashing Becton. I'm not saying I'm out. I'm not saying I don't still think he can be an all-world player. I'm just saying I'm really surprised he made such damning comments about the Jets. What were your thoughts on them? Because like I said, I glanced at them. My first thought was not the best look. Then when I read them over, I was like, oh, my God.
You know, look, I think the guy suffered – you know, 2 years of injury. I try to be as generous as I can when I think about this as a human being. I can imagine like
absolutely
the depression that might come on. Like, you absolutely know what? You're depressed. You overeat. I'm not making an excuse for the guy. I just imagine day to day, like the circumstances of that feeling of like feeling alone and feeling like whatever. I'm not feeling, again, not have to feel sorry for the guy. I'm just saying like, I can imagine you get in the mindset where you're just like not taking care of yourself. You don't want to get off the couch or whatever. And you just spiral into the situation. That said, I would, if I were rising, I said it's unwise to say that. You know, you should say, I'm in the best. You've put yourself in a position where everyone is looking at you going, this guy's in an incredible shape. He's really turned it around. He's turned the corner. It's sort of like, you know, you get in a fight with your wife, you know, and things are like sort of like trending in the right direction for 3 months. You shouldn't just turn around and go, and oh yeah, 3 months ago, blah, and just sort of like go back to that stuff. If you can move forward again, you may have to work through issues, but like not, especially not in public. You don't say to Thanksgiving dinner, like,
exactly,
she was impossible last summer. I could barely stand her.
Facebook
like, she
post.
Drove me crazy. It's my fault. Right. It's my fault. Exactly. It's her fault. All this bad stuff happened, but you know, I'm like, look at me now. I'm like, been working out, you know, it's like, you know, so I don't know, like,
cause there's so much positive going on.
Right. Like, you know, and again, in private, you want to say, you want to, you know, have a tough talk with the coach or something and say, like, I really feel you put me in a bad position. And, you know, I think he legitimately thinks that. I mean, I guess unless his agent said, go out there and blame the coaching staff from last year. I mean, that would be kind of terrible advice too, because all this stuff, like, you know, yeah, if he goes out, like, on the, you know, Jets don't resign him. You know, they don't sign him. He goes out in the free agent market. People, you know, teams look at that and go, is this guy disgruntled or like whatever. You know, it's not saying it's like the only thing to decide, but like it definitely is not. I don't think it checks anyone's box as a good thing. Like if you're like ripping.
Exactly. It's like, staff. What is he helping? What's the benefit? Dylan, what were your thoughts, man?
I was going to say the top line of the notes that I took from this entire article, and it's only one line, was what everybody should have been focusing on, which was Mekhi Becton working with a Long Island-based trainer for the last 3 months and is down from 394 pounds to 342 pounds.
That should have been the theme of the article, right?
Exactly. Yet I have almost a page of copy and pasted quotes out of this article that just make my jaw drop. It's just like, why now? And like Greg said, it's like you've been building up all this positive publicity, exactly. Posting the selfies in the gym, doing like the workout, inspiring kids to go work out and lose weight themselves. Yep. Like it's just been incredible. And then you turn around and you're like, okay, now this is what actually happened. And look at all this kind of laying out the dirty laundry. And I don't really like that whole look. And I agree, maybe right tackle probably wasn't the best beneficial spot for him, but he probably wasn't the best left tackle if they view Dwayne Brown as the best left tackle. And also when you come in overweight and a little unhealthy, your conditioning is poor, it's going to tend to lead to more injuries. So I feel like it's not a matter of, this article was kind of just pointing it all at the Jets, and I feel like there's some accountability that he also needs to take. And if he said at the front of the article, like, hey, I know I was out of shape and overweight, but I really pushed myself hard and this and that. And no, it was kind of just like, yeah, I knew that I wasn't a right tackle. I got hurt. And now I'm kind of just like blaming it on being a right tackle. And now that's his excuse to being a left tackle again.
Look, and especially, right. Sorry to talk over you.
No, you're fine. We all know this.
Everyone's like going like, he was overweight last year. And again, again, I'm not trying to like crucify the guy. I'm just saying it wasn't like he came into shape in incredible shape. And it's like, my knee is buckling. It doesn't feel right. And he's telling coaches, like, you might have a defense. Like, I might be more sympathetic if it was like, you know, he's in as best shape as he could be. He's like, my knee isn't really holding up. He tells the coaches and he gets hurt. Like, you know, but that means like, you know, again, like if I gain 150 pounds, right. If I gain 100 pounds and I'm like, you know, it's like I'm running or something like that. My knee, it's like, you can't just say like, oh, my wife told me to go running and it's her fault. It's like, well, no, it's actually like throwing my wife under the bus left and right, by the way. She's a great lady. She's my wife. Right?
Greg's
my
wife just catching strays. She's like, yeah, Greg, seriously. Why don't you go do another podcast?
Right. We love you, Denise. You're all good. Your best wife, like, honestly, incredible. You know, it's just like, but like, seriously, it's like, you know, like, it'd be like turning around and blaming stuff. Like, you're not in shape. And like, someone's like, you said you want to run this marathon. Like, go try to run it. Or you just got to start training. Like, you're like 2 days in training. Like, I'm fine, man. You're like, you gained 150 pounds. You know, like, what's wrong with you? You can't like just, you can't turn around and blame the person who's basically saying it's your responsibility to go out there and play. So, you know, it's just, look, I think it is the inspirational stuff. And again, like the sort of like putting your foot down and saying, I'm not going to play right tackle. I think, you know, maybe in private, you go in, you scream at Salah. That's whatever. You go in the coach's office and you scream and say, don't want to play right tackle. But like in the newspaper, you're going to say with Dwayne Brown, who's like out there with like his arm falling off and he's playing. Like, are you seriously? You're going to say like, I don't want to play this position.
And the other part of that is, and I wrote this in the piece that I wrote, again, I'm glad you brought it up because it was another really baffling piece where, and I've said this before, there is a world in which Mekhi Becton may very well be the best left tackle on the roster, but that's not 100%. What's best for the team. I mean, if you're going 100%. To play the best five and Mekhi Becton and Dwayne Brown are both in that top five and Dwayne Brown has only ever played left tackle, but Mekhi has played both spots, he moves to right tackle likely for this year. And then if he stays, he plays left next year.
Yep.
But that was another thing. And I wrote that. I think I said like Mekhi Becton, not in the critical way, but more in like a, like I'm confused way. I'm like, he has to understand that, right? He has to know that, like, Mekhi, you're playing the right side because the guy on the left, who you may be better than, and even if let's give that to you, let's say you're the better option, but he's never played on the right, and we need the five best guys out there.
And he's 40 years old.
Right tackle is what makes sense. And that's what I mean. I gotta tell a 39, 40-year-old tackle, like, hey, we're gonna start working your right tackle this week. You know, a left.
Are you serious?
Can't teach old dog new tricks.
I would love to know what Dwayne Brown thinks. I mean, I made
that, and that was the other part. I'm like, here's a respected veteran. Like, guys in the locker room respect Dwayne Brown. And Mekhi's just coming out like, oh, I'm taking that job. He's got my job. It's like I said, I came away from that article and I thought, who's advising him? Because, and I'm not saying Mekhi's a bad guy. I'm not saying I'm not rooting for him. I'm not saying he's not going to be great.
I admire his progress he's made, and I honestly hope he's going to be like a star, obviously, this year. I hope.
Right.
Of course.
And what I came away from, my opinion out of that article was, I don't think he's on this team after next year. Like, I think this year, it's really hard to see a scenario where he's on the team in 2024 and beyond, because you look at the scenarios, they didn't pick up the 2024 option. So he's already on,
which they
on
couldn't.
The last
I mean,
year.
Which they couldn't.
They could never do that. No, it didn't. No. Nothing justified it. If he plays well,
it would be like malpractice.
Exactly. If he plays well, you're now looking at possibly a $20+ million a year left tackle. And I don't think they're going to pony up all that cash for a 1 year product, essentially. And then if he does bad or he gets injured, obviously he's gone either way. So, like, I think no matter how you slice it, you hope that he has a great year for the Jets. And then at worst, you hope that if they do let him go, he brings you back a comp pick. And unfortunately, that's what we have to look at as Joe Douglas's first draft pick ever as the Jets general manager. But if that's all you get out of it, it's unfortunate. But we get one solid year and then he moves on. I think that's probably the most likely case for him.
And you mentioning that, Dylan, reminds me of the quote that the article ended with. To me, was him saying he was likely going to leave. Now, I'm not saying that's what he said. But if you read the whole article where he says, where he's lukewarm on his response about what he thinks about the coaching staff, and then he says, they're the reason I got hurt, and they're playing me in the wrong spot. They're not doing what's best for me. And then he closes the article by saying, essentially, if you get on my bad side, don't try to get back on my good side.
It is interesting because, like, you don't,
No, go ahead, Greg. Sorry.
Yeah, I was just going to say, like, I'm going to go back to being an old man here. It's like, I actually remember as a kid, living in Queens, Yankees with Reggie Jackson saying, I'm the straw that stirs the drink, and how much that pissed off Thurman Munson. And, like, it's interesting. Like, again, it speaks to the maturity of the locker room and how good this coach is, because, like, you didn't hear, like, people sniping back. Like, I did not read any articles where anyone said anything to the press about it, where, that could be like, I could imagine some guys in the room, the offensive linemen, were really offended by that. I mean, I could imagine they would be like, are you seriously saying that about Dwayne? Because the way it felt to me, like, it felt like it was, like, disrespectful to Dwayne Brown.
That was my first thought, yeah.
But to think again of, like, how, like, there hasn't been, like, all this, there's always going to be drama as the Jets, right? But, like, there has not been this, like, the type of drama we've seen in the past with, unnamed sis, people in the locker room, and, like, Santana, whatever, this person saying this, and, DeSantoni Holmes, like, pushing. You didn't see, like, that type of, like, negative vibe come out of this story, which is, like, almost like it was, like, it just came and went. And again, we sort of are shocked by it in some ways, but, like, you didn't hear the response that you typically would expect, I think, in New York, finding somebody to kind of speak out about that, or being, like, grumbling about that, or just, the coaches are too soft on him or something. I can imagine that narrative could come out with a different coach. The coach is put up with, just too soft on him. He lets them get with everything.
Yeah, and Saleh nipped it in the bud right away in the presser. He's like, I'm not going to comment on it. And that's 100%. What he should do, because let Mekhi say his piece publicly. You keep your side in-house. And I feel like we've seen this plenty of times. The side that's speaking the most publicly usually has the most to gain from the situation. So the Jets are just going to sit back, let him go prove to them that he's the best left tackle. He said in the article, they've been playing him as the third tackle. I don't know if that means the top priority tackle at both spots, like the swing tackle, or if third on the depth chart behind possibly Carter Warren or Max Mitchell. But either way, he said it, he wants to come into practice and take the left tackle job. And if that's the case week one, and you have to make sure that there's no questions to you being the left tackle, or else I don't see him starting at left tackle this year.
Right. And again, all the, like, positivity, I'm all about it. Like, I really am hoping for that. I hope Mekhi has a great year, even if it, like, goes off. He can't be signed by the Jets. He goes off and he has a good 5-10 year in NFL career. I really do hope that for these guys, because these guys are, like, and again, all seriousness, obviously his knee is problematic. These guys are giving up a lot to do this in terms of physically. We all know the stories of the guys with their bodies. And, like, so I'm hoping he gets a big payday and does well for himself. But yeah, I mean, like, whoever advised him, like, I don't know, like, and I don't think Bob Glau did anything wrong in the article at all. I think he just, like, asked the questions and got the answers, but it's just like,
yeah, you can't blame him.
Serve. And he's like, and then Mekhi to be like, this is the real story. And again, like, I'm not Mekhi throwing Glauber on the bus, but he sort of like was like basically like amplifying a bingo and like, yeah, this is 100% what I think, you know, like instead of saying, you know, maybe I would have tweeted out like, good article, you know, a lot of stuff spoken about in the last few months, made a lot of progress. I'm really happy with the future going forward. And just like, you know, and then sort of like at least spun it like, I said that 4 months ago, 3 months ago, which I imagine the interview was probably, the interviews were done over a period of weeks, you know, and just sort of say, we're moving on. Like, instead of like, being like putting your foot down and being like, hell yeah, I still agree with this. Like, you know, it's just like, I don't know. It just doesn't seem like the wisest course of action.
Yeah. I actually had, and I forget the person's name. I think he was, I don't know. He was a writer of some type, had a sort of unfortunate interaction on Twitter. I don't have many of those. I've had a few this past few days though. But me in trying to be charitable to Mekhi Becton, and, you know, literally as I read it and hoping, I'm thinking, okay, they're going to talk to Becton about this sometime next week. And he's going to say something was misunderstood or even misquoted, or that's not what I said. Well, I was expecting
I spoke
some
out of emotion.
Right.
Right. I so was emotional when I spoke.
When I tweeted his quote, I having expected him to, I don't know if backtrack is the right word, but I was so shocked at what he said that I kind of said, I tweeted out one of the quotes and just said, look, I don't know if any of this, if his words were twisted or if he was misquoted by accident or if he was just misquoted, but here's what Mekhi Becton said. So that was me trying to be charitable to Mekhi right. Becton, not realizing, you know, somebody, I don't know if this was he sure acted like he was a good friend of Bob Glauber. Somebody replied and was like, what are you saying about Bob? He's a great guy. He would never misquote. And I'm like, guy, listen, I'm like, people in the media misquote sometimes. Like, I'm not.
Right.
But then I got mad because instead of like approaching it like, hey, man, maybe that is what he said. Like, it sort of had like a confrontational tone. So I responded to that. Like, right. Then I just started getting snarky and wasn't taking it seriously. You know, the whole like, you know, it'll be okay. You know, I stand with you in this difficult time. Stuff like that.
Yeah. I mean, look, it's not. It wasn't Manish, for, right? It was like Glauber is, like, you know, I think we, whatever. I mean.
Yeah, Glauber's, I have no issues with Glauber. It was me, like I said, trying to be charitable to Becton and
right.
hoping he was going to say that's not exactly 100%. What I meant, but
right, yeah, right. I was misinterpreted like, or something like that, right?
Yeah, so it was kind of wild, but yeah, listen, Becton is he's a huge, you know, no pun intended, he's a huge part of this team and what's going to happen moving forward, and you know, does he hang around?
That would be like incredible, right? That would be like an incredible bonus.
Oh my god,
have a solid year. Yep.
Look, I say that's like to me when you have especially a young, talented guy get injured, like, you know, whether it's after week three or week five or just week one, when a guy misses the season, my thought, because in trying to be as optimistic as possible, my thought process is like, well, at least when that guy comes back next year, it's almost like you got an extra first round pick because you yep. didn't have him right. this year, you know, but now right. we're on year two of that with Mekhi because I thought that last year. Because we've, you know, you look at this offseason as a whole, I feel like there were some moves that could have been made in some other spots that I still hope will be made. But that's one spot where you think if Mekhi Becton comes back and plays the way he did as a rookie, next to Elijah Vera Tucker, with these two running backs who, you know, Breece may have a slow start with the injury recovery, but right, between probably. Hall and Abanacana, like these are big play home run, 70-yard touchdown run backs. Right. And if Becton right. and Vera Tucker are right on the right side, and you have a quarterback where defenses can't just say, okay, we'll just put 11 guys in the box and we'll be fine because the quarterback can't throw. Like a quarterback who's going to be able to make plays with a running game that could be one of the best in the league if Mekhi Becton is right. He's such a big part of this whole picture that his health could have a huge impact on how far this team goes.
And I think I would even go as far as to say he could like buck potential trends down the road of if he plays all 17 games or even 16 games at like the level that he was at as a rookie, he could be in contention for comeback player of the year. Like it's like
100%.
The great point. Realm of possibilities for this guy are just yep. so wide. And it's unfortunate.
We
that,
saw the talent. You know, I mean, that's the thing. We saw the exactly. talent. Everyone saw the talent. He was like destroying people. I mean, he was like for those 4 or 5 games, it was like, and again, that, you know, at the end of the day, like, it's not matter 5 years from now if he ever plays like that again. You know, it's going to be an unfortunate, like, flip that's, you know, he had that little early success. It's just, you know, do hope he does it. But if he can play like that or even like in the universe of that, like, we're going to be so lucky. I got to say, just lucky.
Exactly. Tackle is definitely the high variance position on offense for sure. You could say they're the weakest group on the entire offense. And then you say it has the potential to be a top two, top three group when it comes together with both tackles, Dwayne Brown, Mekhi Becton, or however you, you know, combine the two out of the five spots there on the offensive line. Anything else there on Mekhi for you, Glenn?
No, I'm good with Becton. You know, like I said, I always have and still do support the guy. I just thought those comments were very ill-advised. It's unfortunate that he, as you know, Greg made the perfect point that you kind of decided just to take all these steps back after all this positive that was sort of flowing in the right direction. So we'll see where it goes.
Yep. All right. What do we have next? Oh, we do have a signing. A roster move was made today. The Jets did sign a wide receiver from a rookie minicamp tryout, Jerome Kapp, Division II wide receiver from Kutztown, which is actually about an hour away from where I live. Glenn, I'm not sure if you had any thoughts on Jerome, if you had seen any film of him, if you in your wild dive of film that you do.
I didn't dive quite that deep.
I didn't think so.
I will say he is my favorite 6 foot plus wide receiver out of Kutztown, who names
there you go.
He's definitely number one in that category.
Right.
Yeah, I think when you wear number 21 as a wide receiver in practice, like the graphic showed that the Jets Twitter account posted when they signed him, I'm like, yeah, nobody's really like putting you on their radar just yet. And some players have come out and said he, you know, balled out at practice today. I think it was Jermaine Johnson said he balled out at practice. So they signed him.
It happens, you know. It's
rare. They need guys to play special teams at the wide receiver position, and this is probably the guy to do it. I mean, he's a the last guy on the roster right now, but. In the corresponding move, they do put Bradley and I, depth defensive end, on injured reserve. He's from the Cowboys, just kind of been a practice squad guy for the Jets. So not really a major move there. And I think that wraps up all the football talk. I think we can get into
– Let's talk about music.
The real stuff. Yeah, yeah.
Wait a minute. Whoa. Time out.
We got one more.
Sopranos. We got the Sopranos. And I saw the headline that apparently – Aaron Rodgers doesn't like Sopranos, and that's like breaking news at the New York Post or something like that.
Uh-oh. Well, I haven't heard
so many favors.
Oh, you didn't see that? Like, I guess he said something like, I wasn't really much of a Sopranos guy. So suddenly, of course, like, it's like blood in the water for New York, you know, tabloids. They're like Sopranos and Jets. Like, let's like, you know, they're like, you know, it just was silly. Right. But
I will say this. I'll back Aaron Rodgers up on that. And I'll give my excuses to why I'm in the same boat. Sopranos. So obviously it was, you know, as it gained steam is like this sort of the best show on television for a while.
Right.
I thought to myself, I'm going to watch that show. Like, you know, I'm going to wait till it's about to wrap up so I can just run through every season and, you know, binge the whole show. All my friends tell me how great, I mean, as you know, I live in England now. I was at work one night and this guy was like literally the first shift I ever worked with him. And he's like, oh, you're from New York. And I'm like, yeah. And he's like, what do you think of The Sopranos? And I'm like, you know, and he's like, oh, there's a great podcast. Like he listened all the time. And so huge fan. But yeah, so I waited. Yeah. I was like, I'll wait till the end. I start watching season one as the final season of The Sopranos is airing. And I'm getting toward the end of it. I'm like, and I'm getting into it. I'm like, oh, this is going to be really good. I'm going to really enjoy this. And then the Sopranos ended. And the ending was, it was so loathed by so many fans that I heard about it. So I knew how the whole thing ended, which sucks. Right. And I heard the anger in so many people's voices about how mad they were that I was like, I think I'm going to stop now. Like these people are like, they want to hunt down the writer and get this guy. So I watched season one and I know how it all ends.
Right.
And why I didn't watch from there. But I've been told like, watch it anyway. It's that, like, even though you know how the final scene is, watch it anyway.
One more quick thing we get to music, which is that, this is actually is on music. So I did, like, was interested to see that Aaron Rodgers likes Taylor Swift. And so I just want to give a quick SOS for my beloved niece, Lily, who doesn't have a ticket to go see Taylor when she's going to be in the New York area this weekend. If anyone does DM her, I mean, like, she's going to have a ticket and get to go. So help out Lily.
Yeah, that's I know it's one pain. Taylor Swift song. I only know one Taylor Swift song, Greg, that I think there's one because I saw the video where they asked the Jets players the favorite song, and one of them named a song that I think I've heard of, but I don't know it. but I know you belong with me because an artist that you and I have discussed a fair bit on Twitter, one of my favorites, Butch Walker.
Yeah.
I don't know if you've heard, have you heard his version?
I have not.
Butch Walker, and this was so great. I don't know what inspired him to do this. I think it was, I don't know if it was after an award show or a gig or whatever. He put out a short video of himself going back to the studio one night with a ukulele, and Butch plays every instrument. And he did a remake of You Belong With Me using the ukulele and playing every instrument. And he kind of does this video like every sort of 30 seconds. It's a quick snapshot of him filling another coffee mug. So he's like burning the midnight oil in the studio, doing a remake of You Belong With Me that apparently like won some awards or like Taylor Swift acknowledged it as a great version.
That's cool.
So check out Butch Walker's version of You Belong With Me. You know, Butch, not the biggest name guy. I actually told my wife before we started recording, Greg, I don't know if you remember this. You know, she's being British. She doesn't watch American football all that intently, but she is interested in the pod. And if we have a cool guest coming on, I tell her. And I said, I was explaining to her who you were, and I said, oh, actually, because of Greg, this is sort of. It was almost like imagine being at a party and you're talking to someone and one of your idols comes up to talk to them, but they don't acknowledge you, but you don't care because they're standing there. You and I were talking on Twitter one day. And I think I mentioned that the first albums I ever bought were Slave to the Grind and Skid Row, Slave to the Grind, and Alice in Chains, Facelift.
Great albums, yeah.
And Sebastian Bach jumped into the conversation and like to talk to you because he'd read your book. So I'm scrolling my Twitter and it's like Sebastian Bach has commented on your whatever. I was like, what?
He's got to be on next week.
This is crazy. So I go in and it's like, and I'm like, oh, well, of course he's not talking to me, but I don't care. He's in my conversation, like Sebastian Bach, who I actually, when we went, me and two of my best friends, who I grew up with, you know, we grew up watching listening to Guns N' Roses as kids. And a few years ago when GNR announced the reunion, we went out to, we flew out to Vegas. Like they were living in Boston. I was living in Philly and, you know, we didn't care. We were like, we're flying out. I didn't care if it was in China. Right. We were going to the first show. So we go out there and, funny part of it, I thought one of my friends was pulling my, cause you know, Greg, you know, the story about, you know, the tour a million years ago that got delayed because of the axle when they had to build him that walking boot. Cause he hurt his leg or whatever it was back in the '90s. And we fly out to Vegas. Me and my friend and my other friend was meeting us out there. And the flight lands and my buddy logs onto his phone. And I was sure he was pulling my leg. He turns around, he looks at me and he goes, Axel hurt his foot. Because as you remember, he injured himself at the Troubadour show the night before. And I was like, yeah, whatever, dude. And he holds his phone up and shows me. And my heart sank. Like, we just landed in Vegas. Like, and he's broken his foot again. So the funny part of that was that the most recent show I'd seen prior to that was the Foo Fighters in Philly.
Yeah.
In Jersey, the Susquehanna Center, I think it was called.
Yeah.
And Dave Grohl had broken his foot and had that awesome throne. Chair that he had throne. Built.
Yeah.
So we're like literally first, second row, you know, standing room. So we're like 5 feet from this chair that was just like that thing has to go to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Right. So we land in Vegas. We get to the venue, you know, that night or the next night, whatever it was. And so the most recent concert I've seen was Dave Grohl in this awesome chair. And then out rolls Axl Rose on the same chair. Like Dave Grohl loaned it to him. I was like, that was like the last concert I was at. The guy was sitting there. Yeah. So I was like, very, very surreal moment. But
cool.
Just some of the interactions, though. I mean, you're obviously you love that scene. You love the music, the Van Halen era.
Yeah.
There's probably not a Van Halen fan on the planet that isn't following you on Twitter. And if you're out there and you like Van Halen and you're not following Greg, he is the official Van Halen historian. What got you into that scene and who are some of your other favorite bands from that era?
Yeah. I grew up, you know, in Jersey in the '80s, and I actually saw Van Halen at the Meadowlands at the old Brendan Byrne Arena, which was what it was originally called in the '80s. And, you know, I just became a huge kind of fan for life. And, but you know, that whole period of time, I mean, like whatever, you know, like Motley Crue, Rat, you know, Rush, but I still, you know, the basically the classic bands at the time are like Led Zeppelin, which is kind of weird to think about, like in 1986, like the last Led Zeppelin album had come out, you know, in theory in 1982, but like basically 1979. So it was only like a few years, like, but they were like the dinosaurs. They were like the ancient, like giants or whatever.
The old guys, yeah.
Pink Floyd, right? Pink Floyd, all those bands. So yeah, I mean, it was a great era of music to grow up in. And, you know, I just grew up as a guy who loved history. I had a father who was a professor and was really interested in history. And I kind of it all sort of rolled together for me and my love of music and my love of history. And I got through the book on Van Halen. But, yeah, I mean, like, you know, the same thing for me. It comes back to the Jets as well. I remember hearing at some point that Mark Gastineau and Eddie Van Halen were friends. It was like a little thing in Rolling Stone or whatever. Yeah. And I remember reading sometime years later that, like, actually when like 85, 86, that Eddie and Mark and Valerie, Eddie Van Halen, Mark and Valerie all were in, like, I don't know, like Malibu or someplace. They were all like basically like Gastineau was like training with Valerie. Like she was working for some, you know, to do something where she had to be really shape a movie or something like that. And like the fact that, like, I found out that, like, my Guitar Hero was like friends with Mark Gastineau, I was like, that was like even more juice for me as a fan. And I always thought that was kind of a cool thing to think about, those pictures you can see of Eddie and Mark together on the sideline of that Jets preseason game. Yeah. That they were like buds. And it turns out, like, if, you know, if you talk to a couple of people who knew Eddie back there, he wasn't really a Jets fan. I think he was actually a Los Angeles Raiders fan, but he was, you know, an NFL fan and was just a friend of Mark's and like really liked Mark as a person. They had met some television show or something like that. And that they were like buds was really cool.
That's actually a really interesting story. I didn't know that was the tie-in to the Jets there, because my first question for you was kind of a similar tie-in to the Jets. And I was doing a little bit of research. I called my brother and my stepdad. Those are like the two, you know, metal guys, rock guys that I go to find out all my information. And my brother told me that there's two brothers in the founding members of the band, Alex and Eddie Van Halen. And then he said the same thing with AC/DC with Angus and Malcolm Young.
Yep.
And I was like, well, I wonder if that, like, kind of ties into similarly to Quentin and Quincy. Do they have a better chemistry? Do they just kind of pick up where each other leaves off? And I feel like when you're the drummer and the guitarist, you kind of set the tone for the band. So did that brotherly instinct kind of kick in with music similarly like it would with a sport?
Yeah, and I think so. I mean, I think it's, you know, one of the things that really is – when you talk about Angus and Malcolm or the Van Halen brothers, that they only almost have like they can anticipate what the other person's going to do. And that just comes from, like, you play together in a bedroom and you play together in a basement for years and you go play in clubs together. So you have, like, that's, you basically become like one brain when it comes to music. And I think, you know, I think that's really interesting to think about with Quentin and Quincy. And of course, you know, the fact that Quincy has gotten his contract and Quentin hasn't, it's sort of like, you know, I always wonder what that's like. I think all the signs are that Quinnen is going to get paid, and I think it would be very surprising to me if they did not extend him. But yeah, you know, that I would love to have those guys talk about that, sort of like, you know, when Quincy's lined up behind his brother, like, is he like already know like what his brother see, like he's you know, he's looking at the field and his brother's looking at the field, already like knowing, like, oh, my brother's gonna, you know, my brother is gonna do this. I know what move he's gonna do. He's gonna rip this or do this type of move to get into the backfield, and already has that anticipation. I mean, it's a really interesting thing. I think I asked Michael Nania about the sacks by brothers, and he knew, like, whoever the all time leaders of brothers who have sacks, and he's like, they'd really have to like work to catch up Quincy and Quinnen, but it'd be cool. I mean, they really could like have you know, I think both of them have a chance to have good long NFL careers, and I really like what Quincy has brought. I mean, he's kind of, I know he's sort of like a boom and bust sometimes. He has these big misses and stuff like that. But I think overall, his entire body of work has been very positive. And he's a big, you know, we've been looking for years for like linebackers who weren't going to be like running behind a wheel route, you know, like the Patriots would run the same wheel route every game. And it was like, you know, some like 260-pound linebackers like chugging things, yes, 10 yards behind him. It was like the same movie over and over again. To have someone who had, you know, has speed to get out there and really make those plays on the edges and stuff like that has been really nice. And he seems like a great kid.
Yeah, that sack stat was certainly interesting to think about, because immediately the Watts and the Boses come into my brain. But that's definitely a thing. And I think that has something to do with, you know, especially being on the same team, like you said, lined up right in front of each other. Like sometimes my brother and I are doing something and he just gives me a look and I know what he's thinking. So I could definitely consider that being the exact same thing. Like, I'm going to shoot this way, you fill this gap this way. So definitely a good tie in there.
Yeah.
I was just going to say, you mentioned Eddie being your guitar hero, and I was just researching guitar solos, and I see that Eruption is number two. I don't know if your rankings match up with this as number two, but I also see that he made the list at number 11 when he did Michael Jackson's Beat It, which was right. completely new information to me. So can you right. talk about just like his range and how he was able to work with all these different artists? And do you think both of them are top 10?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, the thing about the Eruption solo, and there's been a number of, you know, there's been a number of moments in, you know, the history of anything, like you think of like in the NFL, like, you know, maybe the introduction of like the forward pass, or you can think about the introduction of other innovations that sort of changed the nature of the game, right? So like when Eddie Van Halen did the Eruption solo, it sort of set a new standard. It sort of changed the basically what it meant to have like an incredible guitar solo on album. And so yeah, I mean, I think obviously there's room for debate. I'm not a lunatic when it comes to like, you know, to things like I can say like, you know, this, I don't know what number one was, but like, yes, I think the Eruption solo and for its impact on guitar playing and its overall historical importance as a piece of music in rock history, it's like got to be up there in the top five at least. But yeah, I mean, in terms of the Beat It solo, what's really interesting about that is that that was really an instance where Quincy Jones, who was the producer for Michael Jackson, really thought about the fact that he wanted to have Michael Jackson more crossover into rock. Basically there was like much more of a, for lack of a better term, segregation when it came to music, where MTV was playing, you know, mostly like whiter rock in the early 80s, and like a lot of radio stations you turn on, you know, what we consider classic rock today, you wouldn't hear a lot of black artists. And so the fact that Eddie Van Halen, kind of the era's greatest guitar hero, played on a Michael Jackson song, the era's greatest pop star, kind of just made that crossover. Like some rock stations played it, some R&B, like, you know, basically R&B stations or played the Eddie Van Halen Beat It song, you know, and like people are like, oh, who's that guitar solo? That's kind of cool. And it sort of changed the game for that too. You listen to a lot of the music of the era. I don't want to get too into the weeds, but like a lot of the stuff that followed, like a lot of like with black artists suddenly have like these like sort of like guitar solos in them. And it wasn't a thing to put a guitar solo in them, you know, like a Janet Jackson song, for lack of a better term, but like Black Cat comes along in the later 80s.
I was just going to say Black Cat.
Right. It becomes a thing, right? It becomes a thing, like, solo. Like, oh, this is great. So yeah, I mean, it's obviously, you know, to have Eddie Van Halen pass away relatively young has been, you know, kind of a wake up call for, I think, for a lot of people, for just, you know, how like, yeah, all of our heroes are, if you grew up in that era, all your heroes are passing away. Tina Turner, God rest her soul too, just passed away and stuff like that. It's Jeff Beck. And so, you know, kind of the greats are all are leaving us. And so, but yeah, that's two great solos. I would definitely say would be the top kind of, you know, I always think that the Beat It solo is up there in the top solos that Eddie ever did as well, just because of the influence of it, the impact, like I said, it sure. impacted other genres of music, like other artists, basically black oriented artists started to say, I want an Eddie Van Halen style guitar solo in my song because of Eddie Van Halen's solo.
Yeah. Yeah, so I sort of bridged the gap there.
Yep.
I was just going to say, I just had one more, Pink Floyd, Comfortably Numb, was number one on this specific list.
And that's like a good song. I mean, that's like a perfectly reasonable one to say, like, should be in the conversation.
I didn't agree with the entire list per se either, but my brother mentioned, and I'm glad that you mentioned the black artist and the Bridging the Gap. He mentioned Jimi Hendrix's rendition of the national anthem. If you can consider that a guitar solo, that has to be up there as well. So I certainly think that is there. And
perfect. That's a great one.
One last question. It's a bit of like deep dive information. I'm not sure if you're too deep into the band. Yes. But my stepfather wanted me to ask, before they brought on Rick Wakeman as the keyboard player, there were other people that auditioned for that job. And he wanted to know if you knew any of those names and if we could like shine a light on what could have possibly been.
That's like, is that like a Final Jeopardy question? Like, I'm talking,
did you wager?
30 seconds. You got 30 seconds.
I don't know the answer to that question. I'm sure I can figure it out.
Blame your wife.
Phone a friend. Let me call him. Ask him. Yeah, you know, there's another example really quickly of a band that had, you know, multiple evolutions. I mean, completely changed the sound by the 80s, became, you know, very different, same singer, but with John Anderson, but a very, very different song, and became MTV Darlings as well. Another band you're like, yes, it's going to be on MTV a lot. You're like, with their 9-minute songs and their kind of like spacey, you know, prog rock thing, like they kind of down in the Owner of a Lonely Heart and all that stuff. And so, but yeah, I do not know the answer to that question, but yeah, I'm stumped.
Yeah, I just had a thought about how I said, because I was something I was going to mention, Greg, and I'd said a couple weeks ago, you know, and I mentioned earlier about the people who are so critical of Mekhi Becton right now about, you know, he's only getting in shape because he wants the money. He's sort of, Becton is in a no-win situation, right? Like if he hadn't lost the weight, he'd be lazy, but he loses the weight and he's greedy. So no matter what he did, fans were going to hate on him for it. And it kind of, the music tie-in here is how my heart goes out to Wolfgang Van Halen on Twitter with these people who were like, you're making your name on your dad's songs. And he's like, I don't perform any of my dad's songs, but you're using his name. Like, dude, it's my name. Like, I'm not going to change my name because my dad was a musician. Like, and I mean, the kid is out, he's playing every instrument on his album. There is not more he could possibly do to be his own man, his own musician. And you still have these lunatics, probably the same people who still hate Mekhi Becton and think Zach Wilson was drafted based off of one throw.
Right.
Like
right.
these people who just, they get this thought in their head and they're like, they can never get off of it.
Right.
And I watch Wolf Van Halen on Twitter and I'm like, I don't know how you do it, man. Like these people are so out of their minds. But on a positive note, at my age, I am terrible at like taking in and caring about new music. Like I'm the old guy who likes my stuff from when it was cool. Like I'm gonna listen to Faith No More, Metallica, Guns N' Roses. But listen to Wolf Van Halen.
Miami Vice. You're like, forget these new shoes. I want what I want to put on Miami Vice.
Exactly. Give me some Married with Children. I don't need this stuff. You know? But no, Wolf Van Halen, I actually played Distance from my son not long ago because I had the kids watch Back to the Future, which they loved. And I can't remember if this is something you posted, Greg, or if I mean, I'm sure you know it because there is nothing about Van Halen you don't know.
That's not true. Well, not about Yes, too. I mean, like, I'm like,
well, no, this
like reading all these Yes books tonight. I'll be like,
thanks a lot, Dylan.
You got homework now. Yep.
But the scene in Back to the Future, right? When Marty uses the Van Halen cassette, that was Eddie.
Yes, but real Eddie it Van Halen playing,
But it said Eddie Van Halen because the band wouldn't give the rights to just use Van Halen.
So
that's why supposedly the cassette reads Eddie Van Halen because he can obviously claim it.
Yeah.
So because of that, I explained to my son, I was like, the guy playing guitar on that scene right there is one of the best guitarists ever. And he passed away recently and, you know, his son. So I played Distance for him. My son loved it. But how nice has it been, aside from the lunatics, how nice has it been to watch Wolf Van Halen sort of come into his own as a musician and really make some fantastic music? He's opening for Metallica now. I mean, he's done a great job.
I could talk about this for hours. I would just say, like, I've never met Wolf, but I have such, admiration and empathy for him. I mean, obviously you grew up and your parents are celebrities. Everyone thinks like, oh, it's like, oh, like it's all great. Your parents are celebrities. And surely there's great things that come with that. But obviously there's also the expectation that like, yeah, like anything you do is just because who your mom and your dad is basically. And, you know, he could be a guy. I mean, he could just go to Starbucks every day and like just hang out and do nothing. Right. He could. I'm sure he's like in a comfortable enough situation where he could do that, but he's like going out and he's like, not saying like, I'm just going to like play Van Halen songs.
Meaning,
like,
exactly.
I'm Running with the Devil in Panama. Right. I could just play my dad's music and like live off that legacy. He's like going out there and writing his own music. And, you know, look, if he wasn't good, I don't care what your last name is. Your last name could be, you know, could be Sinatra, could be Michael Jackson's kid. It could be anybody's kid. Like if you're not good, you're not going to open for Metallica. They're not going to let like some like amateur and, you know, like terrible band open up for Metallica. I'm sorry. It's like, it's not, you know, certainly like that opens to it. Certainly doesn't help that Metallica opened for Van Halen in 1988. I'm sure that was helpful that Hetfield is like, and those guys are like, hey, it's Eddie's kid. You know, this is great. We want to listen to the music and they like the music. They're going to but they're doing well on these tours and like people like the music. And I think it's, again, I just look at him and I say, you know, here's a guy who has the guts to go out and do something that people necessarily aren't expecting him to do. Like, you know, they're pushing him to do something that's more like in line with what his dad did in terms of music. And he's like, he's out there doing it on his own terms. And, you know, he's just going F you to people. Like, I don't care what you think. I'm going to do what I want. And I'm not going to just basically, you know, crawl on a shell basically. And just basically like, hey, I don't have to face the music in terms of like this. I've got celebrity parents and I can just sort of like ride out my life and not have to like, you know, he's out there like facing the criticism and the sort of the hard reality of like what it takes to be an artist, especially in this era when like everyone can get to you. Like, look, you know, in the back in the day, like when it was a bad interview by, you know, in Cream magazine about Led Zeppelin, like the publicist for Led Zeppelin called and screamed at the reporter and the guys got mad, but it wasn't as if like you had like to pick up your phone, like people were like hurling abuse at like Robert Plant or something like that, right? It was just like, you know, it was just like an annoying interview, and you just didn't give an interview to that journalist again, and you just moved on, you know. So it's a different era, and you know, I know that from what he's talked about, that it was, you know, a long road with his dad with cancer, a lot of like sort of like hopefulness, like, oh, the cancer's in remission, coming back. And we've all had relatives who face that. It's a terrible, hard road. And so, you know, he lost his dad and he was relatively young. And so, you know, I'm pulling for the guy. I always will pull for the guy. And I really just always like secretly, you know, to myself, I don't do a lot of the stuff on Twitter around him, because it's like he doesn't need anyone to like back him up. He's like blowing people up left and right on Twitter, you know. It's like, so it's just like,
he's very witty, like very funny dude. Like some of his replies, like my favorite are the ones where he's being like a really like sarcastic, like F you in the nicest possible way, but people aren't catching it and they're responding as if he's being serious. Right. Like he's really good at that. And just such a likable guy. I can't imagine like being a Van Halen fan and hating on that guy who like all he's doing is making awesome music on his own and being accessible to fans and polite and cordial. Like there's, like I said, there's nothing more the guy can do in my eyes. But look, it doesn't matter. You know, it does not matter who you are. There's always going to be somebody who hates you.
100%.
I was going to say, I was unaware that he was, you know, catching flack from people about using the name Van Halen. Yeah. And it got me thinking, like, I know that there was a potential for the name to be changed of the band when Sammy Hagar took over.
I wonder
if, you know, hindsight, you go back, you change the name to Van Hagar, if they'd actually be giving him crap to this day.
Wolfgang Van Hagar. He just could have called himself Wolfgang Van Hagar.
Wasn't that one of his replies? Didn't I feel like he had a tweet.
Wolfgang Led Zeppelin.
That was it. I'm no longer going to live off my parents' name. My new name is Wolfgang Van Zeppelin. Yeah.
Oh, man. That's a good one.
Oh, Wolfgang Led Zeppelin, right? Yeah.
That was it. Yeah. Wolfgang Led Zeppelin.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, as I get older, and I know Dylan is like tired of us talking about how old we are, but like, you know, you see these young people sort of like progress to, you know, young people, like, you know, he's you know, a couple decades younger, and you see that to sort of like have to like just keep on. You know, you lose people you love in your life and family. I've lost my dad, and I'm sure you guys have lost people you love too. You just have to kind of soldier on. It's tough. And, you know, it's really been nice to see him have a chance to do something totally different with his music. And again, his music, you know, people are like, well, it doesn't really sound like what it doesn't sound like Van Halen. I'm like, well, he was like, you know, he was 10 years old, and, you know, he's not going to be like, he didn't grow up like on the same music we did, like, you know, people in their 50s. Like, so are you surprised that it sounds maybe more like in the range of like 90s, you know, rock than, you know, it's like, it's not going to sound like 1980s music, because that's somewhat not what the kid grew up on. I mean, like, obviously his dad was in the band, he played in Van Halen, but he's like, you have your, you know, he was like, he went to your middle flavor. School like everyone else, right? He went to listen to like Jimmy Eat World and like, you know, Foo Fighters, like every other kid of that era, like you grew up, you're like, that's what you're into. So like, you can't win, right? You're like, doesn't sound enough like Van Halen. Oh, you're living off your dad's name. It's like, just like, you can't win.
Exactly.
There's always going to be somebody who doesn't like you, but not on this show. Greg, loved having you on, would love to have you on again. And I'm not kidding. I'm going to reach out to Dennis Wozzeck, see if the four of us can come on. And
it'd be a pleasure.
I would happily sit and talk about nothing but music for a couple of hours with you guys. That would be fantastic. But again, as I said at the top, check them out. Van Halen Rising, Ted Templeman, producer. Check them out, guys. Both well worth the read. Greg Rainoff. And listen, Greg, I not to go too crazy with the praise, but really, I mean, you love history, you love music, you love the Jets.
Right.
That, as I said, telling my wife at the top, I said, oh, you know, he's a historian. And when I was the last time I did to London with a friend of ours, I'm sending him pictures of the George Orwell pub and the
that was amazing. Yeah, I showed that. I showed that to my wife. She was like,
I told her that. I said he said to me, keep him coming. My wife loves this stuff too.
Yeah.
So history guy, love it. I actually. You can't see it because it's so dark, but that's to me a perfect poster. It's, I forget which tour it was that GNR did. They had every city they did an individual poster for that city with a historical reference tied in with the band.
Awesome.
So that's the Boston Garden show with a Guns N' Roses skeleton riding a horse as Paul Revere carrying the lantern through Boston. Yeah, exactly. And I saw that poster, and actually my wife got it for me as a gift. She saw me admiring it, because that was actually at a time I was reading one of the Revere books that I read, and I thought, there's a Guns N' Roses Paul Revere poster, like if ever there was a poster for me. So great guest. Mate, one day we'll have you on to just talk history. Like, love it. Great time. Greg Rainoff, like I said, check him out, folks. Follow him on Twitter at Greg Rainoff. Anything you want to add, Dylan, Greg?
I was just going to say thank you so much for coming on. It's been a pleasure. I mean, not just the football aspect, but like Glenn said, the music aspect as well. It's nice to, you know, talk about these things in the off season when football is a little slow, although it's never really slow for the Jets, but we certainly appreciate it.
Well, listen, when the Jets win the Super Bowl, we're going to have Guns N' Roses and like with Wolfgang Van open in MetLife Stadium. We're just going to like parade. They're going to Axel's going to lead the parade right down Fifth Avenue.
Oh man. If he doesn't break his foot.
Yeah, you can't show up. You'll break his foot, Glenn. Come on.
Hey, right. I appreciate you guys. This is
thank
awesome.
You so much.
See you again soon. Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it. It was really fun.
Absolutely, Greg. Take care.
Yep. Take care.
Take care. See you.
See you.
All right. There he goes. That's Greg Rainoff, everybody. You can follow him on Twitter at Greg Rainoff, obviously. Van Halen historian, author. Check out his book, Van Halen Rising and Ted Templeton. I'm going on Amazon right now to see if I could purchase both of them. So any last comments here before we get on out of here as you show the books one more time?
Yeah. Ted Templeton. So this is the more recent one, Life of a Music Producer, produced some of the biggest bands and albums ever. And Van Halen Rising talks about Van Halen starting from playing proms and backyard parties all the way up until, you know, being one of the biggest bands in the world.
Yeah, that's awesome. And I learned just in a little bit of research and trying to, you know, scrounge up some questions for Greg here. I came across so much cool information. And, you know, I won't forget when I was, you know, sitting in traffic on the highway in South Carolina, and I saw the tweet from Wolfgang about his father passing. And I was, you know, I'm bummed, I'm sitting in traffic, but I throw on Hot for Teacher and I, you know, you just start jamming. So like, it brings it all back. So it's nice to, like,
it's funny. I meant to mention that, to Greg, that one of my earliest memories, as a fan of music was, in 1984, which was the album Van Halen put out at that time. I lived in California at the time. It's funny. I lived in so many places. I do one show and mention like eight places I live. People must think I'm lying. Oh, there's Glenn again. Another place he lived. That was the time he lived in New Mexico, you know, but no, I did. I lived everywhere. But when I lived in California and that album came out, I think I was young enough yet that I didn't quite understand why I liked the video so much, but I couldn't stop watching the video. I was like, this is really good. I don't know what's so good about it. Like, I was seven. But as you get older, you're like, oh, that's why I like that video so much.
That's exactly why we like the video.
My earliest music memories is listening to Hot for Teacher, but really watching the video for Hot for Teacher. But there's that, you know, that great when the lights go off and Eddie Van Halen is leaning over and walking up and down the desks playing the guitar. Just epic video, great song, great band. And yeah, I could seriously, we could have him and Dennis on and do a 6-hour show talking about music.
Seriously. And we're probably going to have to get that, relatively soon, probably before camp, if we could, that'd be great. But all right, we're gonna wrap it up on that one. For Glenn, you can follow him on Twitter at JNRadio_Glenn. You can follow his draft account at Jets Picks at Jets PICKS. I've already seen tons of 2024 guys, and as soon as we get off this and I eat dinner, I'm going into some 2024 offensive lineman prospects. So that's gonna be fun. So definitely be on the lookout for Glenn's draft account. Follow me on Twitter at D Terriman and follow Jet Nation on all social media platforms, Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, Instagram. And then one last time, follow Greg Rainoff. If you're into the classic rock history, all that stuff, he's posting tons of great content on his Twitter at Greg Rainoff, Greg R-E-N-O-F-F. That's going to do it for us on this one. I think we do have a video coming out with Chris Schubert this week. Possibly.
Normally we would do tomorrow night. We're not. Something's come up for me. We were going to do a show a little earlier in the day, but we thought, you know what? There's not a ton to cover right now. We're not going to talk about Aaron Rodgers missing 10 minutes of practice with a sore calf. So, we're going to take a pass on a show this week. So no Friday show for me and Chris.
Cool. So this will be the last one in your YouTube feed or podcast feed for the week. And I hope everybody has a happy Memorial Day and we'll catch you guys next week. Let's go Jets.